Hi, everybody. Welcome back to this episode of From the Suggestion Box, Navigating Feedback, the Good, the Bad, and the Say What. Today, I have my esteemed colleague and friend, Mr. Alec Lawson, here joining us today, who, if you have ever had the desire or even just the thought or even the curiosity of working with people with disabilities, well, sit down and get ready because you're about to go for a ride. This man has all the things that you need to know. He is so knowledgeable. And the thing that I love about him is he's so willing to share and educate. And that's just who he is. It's what he does. It's a thread of the thread of who he is. So please welcome Alec. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for having me on. I am so excited to be here and talking with you about all things accessibility. I'm always happy to chat and how to be more inclusive. And you're one of my favorite people to chat all things volunteerism and accessibility with. So very excited to be here.
And I was talking to you a little bit earlier, like, I can't believe it's taken us this long to do this. We've known each other for almost like 2 or 3 years. We've done multiple projects together. And I'm like, how has this not happened? But, you know, timing is everything. So it was just the right time. So, I mean, I know you, I adore you, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself so that our audience can fall in love with you too?
Sure. So, I am Alec Lawson. I am based in Baltimore, Maryland. It's the place I grew up. I love giving back to the community. And I started working in nonprofits. I have a theater degree, which is very exciting. And I started working in nonprofits, I guess, about 12 years ago. And I recently have launched my own consultancy project called VIA, Volunteers Inclusion Access. And we're in the process of developing all of our assets, but I've maintained a couple of contracts through the East Coast to help theaters and nonprofits and answer questions about accessibility and provide services and front of house mentorship and volunteerism. So it's been a really fun journey, I guess, the last 12, 13 years in becoming an accessibility asset and a volunteer engagement professional.
I love it. Okay. So let's start off this way and let's just see where it takes us. What do you think is the greatest misconception that people have working with people with disabilities?
Such a great question, because there is so much ableism that's still very much built into our society, and that ableism manifests in a lot of different ways. It's not always hateful based ableism. Sometimes it is, but it's not always. Sometimes it is that encouragement to be deeply uncomfortable working with volunteers with disabilities or individuals with disabilities. So I think the greatest misconception is that it's difficult, because it's not. And when you're centering the humanity of the person that you're working with, and when you understand even statistically, all of us will have a disability at some point in our life, right? Due to aging, due to accident, short-term disability, long-term disability, what you've been born with. It's really a beautiful spectrum of people across all of our society that it's not hard to do. I mean, for myself, I've had hand tremors for all of my life, and it's something that's not really noticeable. So people don't feel uncomfortable until I'm taking a sip of a martini glass, right? And it shakes a little bit, and then suddenly everyone's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And waiters are rushing over, and it's a whole big thing. But when you really take a step back, it's just, we all approach life a little differently, and it's not hard to do. It's just important that you don't see volunteers or patrons or employees as serial numbers. They are human beings with all kinds of different needs and ways to be built up for success.
I love that. So how have you seen accessibility? What's the word I'm looking for? Evolve, especially in the theater?
That's great. Such a great question, because it has come through such a journey. I mean, when I started my true accessibility journey about 11 years ago or so, I was learning a lot about what theaters offer. And I think what nonprofits and theaters often do is lump accessibility onto someone else's job, right? And that becomes, you know, I signed up for this job, but I'm being asked to do these five other jobs. I'm singing a song that's sung in nonprofits all the time, right? How many hats can you possibly wear at the same time?
Exactly.
So in the evolution of it, we've really seen accessibility, especially moving through DEI initiatives, really start coming to the forefront. And you and I have said before, if you're not doing accessibility, you're not doing DEI at all.
Right.
Because we all have these beautiful intersectional identities. You're not just this one thing. You are comprised of your ability, your race, your gender expression, all of these things. And it's part of this culture that you're built in. I think I see theaters becoming more open to individuals with disabilities. I think that is largely driven by Betty Siegel at the Kennedy Center, who is a hero of mine, the Leadership Exchange in Arts and Disabilities, to just exchange ideas and learnings and all kinds of things and how to work. But yeah, they're more inclusive. They are welcoming more people with disabilities into the conversation, which is great. The work is never done because this world is fully built for, super frankly, able-bodied white straight men. So any type of identity against that, you really have to listen to and understand how to adjust the environment around you. But I do think that they're understanding that accessibility is also more than having wheelchair accessible seats. And even when you think about ADA seating in a theater, it's not just for an individual in a wheelchair. There's many different things that require that seating. And we're really breaking down that barrier of people with disabilities have been taught to hide either themselves or their disabilities before coming into a public space. And that's what theaters are really working to break down. They are becoming more open, more inclusive, and they're making mistakes, but they're making mistakes to grow from instead of not trying at all, which I think is the better path.
Which I like the phrase, like they're failing forward, right? They're like
failing forward. Yes.
Have done what they needed to do, but they've learned from it and we're doing better the next time. Right. Man, you said a lot of stuff. I have a lot of things to say. One of the things that I was thinking about, like you said, I never really appreciated the efforts that the U.S. takes for accessibility till I left the U.S. and I came back and it was like, wow. Just like in a lot of other countries, there's just places that there's just the way things are built. It's just like, it's stairs everywhere. And if you are not, like you said, able-bodied and able to walk upstairs, there's not even an accommodation. It's just kind of like, well, I guess you can't go. Sorry. So after leaving the country several times and coming back, I had like a greater appreciation for that. And what opened my eyes to that was the LEAD conference, which I believe that's where we kind of first connected. I think, I'm not sure, or it was somewhere maybe in our community of practice, the theater where we were all connecting during the pandemic and the VIPCA meeting. I'm not even really sure, but somehow, who cares? It doesn't matter. Because I do know that we did connect like for sure at LEAD. But for people who do not know what LEAD is, can you talk a little bit about it? And do you think it would be helpful for somebody to attend, even if they are not in the arts arena?
Fantastic question. So LEAD is the Leadership Exchange in Arts and Disabilities. It changes, it's the Kennedy Center's access gathering of minds, and there are seminars and classes and people teach different things. So it's a beautiful conference. It always has fantastic minds that come together, and we discuss things from a theater perspective, from a nonprofit, from human services. The government services are there, Parks and Rec is there, and it's really a way of gathering together learnings, because I think in a world, especially post-COVID, it's no longer looking for learnings from just your field, right? You want to look at learnings from other fields, other things people have done, other services that people provide, not just in the spirit of partnership, but thinking outside the box for things. And as we continually evolve as a society and we continually look to embrace people, those individual experiences are really important. So I super recommend LEAD. If you have any interest in going, You should. If you work for a government agency, you should. If you work for a nonprofit, for an arts org, if you work for city planning, if you work in local government, if you are breathing oxygen, I think you should go, right?
Yes.
Because it is a mind expanding, it is understanding different people, it is working directly with people with disabilities, it is hearing their stories, it is hearing from professionals that work with them. And it's also a lot of intersection points. There's disabilities in clients, it is disabilities in volunteers, it is disabilities in professionals, and you see successes and learnings, and as we just said, failing forwards that people are doing. And I think what really helps people is having a shared community of learning so that we all don't have to repeat the same mistakes. We can learn from each other and then move forward and be able to ask really poignant questions and really bring a lot of things back to your individual communities. And to your point, I love that you said, when you leave the country, ADA is purely an American thing. So Ireland has been a great participator in LEAD. We're starting to see it spread a little bit further out. And as a little story, part of my college theater program, I went to the National Theater Institute, NTI, loved it, but we go to Russia. And that's really what shocked me when it came to ADA compliancy. In Russia, there was a fellow classmate of ours that used a wheelchair, and it was just nearly impossible to move through the streets because there aren't even things like sidewalk ramps. And America tends to be backwards, or known to be in backwards for a lot of global issues, but accessibility is not one of them. This is something that we're really trying to move forward. And it's a shout out to the whole Crip Camp movement in a massive protest on the stairs in the 1990s, right?
Yes.
And that's what signed it forward. So it's like, remember, groups of people coming together, groups of citizens coming together, groups of individuals coming together can really make a change in what we do. So remember, attend LEAD, know your disability history, and understand that we can move a system forward together.
Yes. And a matter of fact, now that we're talking, I remember I attended one of your workshops, and I remember like I emailed you and I was like, this was so great. Do you mind if I share this, the resources that you had? And I was so excited because you responded back and you were like, yes, absolutely. Let's have a conversation. And that like the rest was history. That was definitely one of the most life-changing conferences I had ever attended. It was eye-opening. It was educational. It was just either there's, you know, I guess, well, I would say in my life, I was going to say in life, but in my life, there are very few things that had that, like such an impact that has really just changed the trajectory of my life and my thinking as that LEAD conference. It was mind-blowing. It was absolutely mind-blowing. And it was my very first time really interacting with people with disabilities in such a wide gamut. And I left that place so humbled. Not that I ever thought better of, but humbled by how much I didn't know and had a new world view and a new understanding. And so I talk about it all the time because it was just so transformational in my world and my life. And I just look at things so differently now. It's like, I can't, it's kind of like, you know how if there's a particular industry that you work in and you walk anywhere in the world, like you see it from your point of view, you can't unsee it, right? So absolutely, it's like now I can't unsee any of these things. And I'm so passionate about spreading the word and doing what I can. And just even at the conference, and like you were saying, it's for, if you breathe oxygen, just little things like learning about what to put in the job descriptions, like, and your volunteer role in descriptions, just, you know, and that's across the board. It doesn't matter, but just the thinking of the language, thinking of where, thinking of people that you team up with, like just, if you all can go to LEAD, you need to go. I will drop the link. I will drop.
It is so good.
In the show notes and take it from there. Okay.
You know, and
Go ahead.
Sorry, the last thing I want to say, the great lesson about Lee too is disability is cultural competency. And we tend to think of cultural competency in terms of ethnic background, racial background, but right. Disability is a cultural competency. And this gathering of the minds will really help you understand more about the culture of capital D disability, which is very important. And that's my last plug for it.
Well, I don't know if we're done because
that's very true.
Because I just remember when I went, and it was little things, right? Like there was a speaker who was phenomenal, was talking about all this stuff, and he was blind. And I wanted to go up and say something to him, and I didn't know. I was like, how do I go up and speak to somebody who is unable to see? Like something as small, because like if it was like you, I would just come up and like, hey, Alec, did it up. But I was like, if I come up behind him, am I going to scare him? If I come up in front of him, like all of these things and the people there were so kind. They were just like, he's a human being just like you are. How would you do it? If he was able to see, what would you do? And I was like, okay, well, I would do this. And she's like, okay, the only adjustment is you might announce that you're coming up because he may not be aware. That she was like, everything else do the same. And it was just like, okay, you know, just, but it resolved a lot of that for me. It took the fear out of, oh my gosh, I don't know, because we're all in a place where we don't want to offend. But sometimes the fear keeps us from moving forward, which also is not good, because like you said, sometimes we need to fail forward so that we can move forward. Right. So this, I just, you know, yeah, y'all lead all day. All day. That's all I can say. So for somebody who is listening to this and they may not know what the ADA is, do you want to just give like a brief snippet of what that is?
Sure. So I talked a little bit about the history of it, but it was signed into effect in 1990. It is a law. It's the American Disabilities Act. It was signed into effect by George H.W. Bush, the older Bush. And what it means is that there are very specific federal regulations to all things being more accessible to people. And it's gotten updated a few times. I think the last official update was 2017, 2018, because there's a constant move of technology. We've become a much different technological society since 1990. And how does ADA apply forward for that? But it helps define the guidelines of like service animal, places can't refuse service animals. You have to offer a certain amount of performances of things. Anything that is government funded has to be fully ADA accessible. It creates a set of laws for discrimination cases, right? You can't be kicked out of a place. You can't be not welcome to a place. People have to be able to supply reasonable accommodations for things. It helps define what reasonable accommodation things are. It sets what basically saying you don't get to use cost as a reason not to be more accessible. It really makes things more inclusive and more open. And our society completely changed after 1990. There's still ways to go. There's still ethos to go. There's still historic buildings way to go. But a lot of people, it's one of my favorite things that Betty talks about. A lot of people are like, oh, well, like, my institution existed for 1990, so we're like grandfathered in. That's not a thing either, right? And what's great about a set of laws is that they exist, but they still have to get challenged, right? So people do things and then it goes to court and then they have to win or lose and things like that. But it really creates this fantastic framework that doesn't exist in many other countries, you know? And it creates a pathway for people with disabilities to feel equal rights, or at least more rights, to have employment, to have a minimum threshold that they have to earn in order that they're employed. It should be much higher, but you know, it's a process of progress, right? It doesn't solve every problem, but at least brings problems up to the forefront. And my favorite thing about the update of ADA is a lot of website usage, right? And to be able to navigate a website no matter what disability that you're working with, and it holds businesses accountable.
Yes.
There's always a downside to a capitalist society. It's money driven. It tends to dehumanize. So it's really important to have laws in place that maintain the dignity and the humanity of people and not constantly be profit centric. My favorite court case to talk about is that Domino's had gotten sued because they have that really fancy, like, order your pizza, it's moving through the tracker, and it wasn't accessible. And they tried to argue that ADA was for brick and mortar. And a judge was like, it is not. It is for every type of experience. And if anyone can experience something, you make sure people with disabilities can experience it. So Netflix has a fantastic documentary called Crip Camp, all about this experience from basically the mid 70s through 1990 when it got signed. I also super recommend that for people to watch and learn from. And it's really important to remember too that this law got signed because of a massive protest on the stairs.
Yeah.
And it was people in wheelchairs and people with disabilities who laid down and would not move until they adjusted these things. And it's an important victory in our culture, and it's an important lesson, and it's an important thing to carry forward from the people who have fought in the past for these rights.
And oof, it was powerful.
It was very powerful.
I didn't see the documentary. I may have to go and watch that. But I did see like different clips of different things, and it was just like us talking about it is nothing like seeing it. And it's like, and sometimes that's what it takes. Sometimes you have to see that to where it's like, man, okay, I didn't realize. It was powerful. And I am so glad that you talked about cost, because it was one of the things I was going to talk about. Again, after I came from LEAD, I was like, okay, we're going to make our whole program accessible. We're going to do everything. And it's just like, well, sometimes, yes, it can cost. But I love what you said, that cost is not an excuse. One of the things that we had to start doing was, and what actually is very cost effective, is when you are building out anything, like if it is brick or mortar, or even if it's your program or whatever, when you are in the building out part of it, and accessibility is a part of the threat of it, it's nowhere near as costly, either like literally or theoretically, as if you do it and then have to be retroactive. Building it in from the get-go, getting people's perspectives in as you are building it, is so much easier than like, oh man, we have to break this down and redo it because we didn't think about. And just being, just even that, if that was one of the like millions of things that I got from LEAD, it was thinking about that, like from not making it an afterthought, making it a part of every other part of your checklist, that's, you know, add that to the checklist and put it in, and then budget ahead of time for it. So even if it's, maybe you can't do one big, huge thing, you can start small. We all, you know, you have that budget. What is one small thing that you can do to tweak? Because otherwise, you know, it's very easy to use the cost as an excuse to get out of anything, including this. So I love the fact that you brought that up.
So what I also love is that you are describing two amazing concepts that both of us, I know, are deeply students of. One is universal design, right? So in universal design, you think about it from the start. The easiest way I can always simplify universal design is, say you have a projector in a space, an event space, a theater, whatever. And I think in a lot of theaters and a lot of kind of that hole in the wall indie theater that we all love, a lot of the tech is like, okay, so you have to like climb up this ladder and then move through this shaft like you're in Die Hard, and then you get to this little room with the projector.
Yeah.
And it's like, but what if that projector was actually in a space that was already accessible, right? So that if you had a designer who is in a wheelchair that can fully design your projections for your show despite being in a wheelchair, because it's not a requirement, you don't have to suddenly make all these accommodations.
Right.
You think about it from the start. right? Like, and it's not even just having someone in a wheelchair. You can have a projectionist that suddenly has to use a scooter for their knee because of a temporary injury.
Right.
Or you could have a projectionist who's pregnant and can't climb the ladders. And right. It's important that we build these inclusive environments for that. And then the other thing you touched on, which you and I have talked about, that 1% change every day, that slight difference, that's the Atomic Habits, right? And Atomic Habits is a fantastic book I think everyone should read. But it is that if you make a 1% change every day, by the end of the year, you've made at least a 300% change in everything, right?
Yeah.
And just making those really small changes, just making, especially changes to things that are typically overlooked, like a projector placement in a large event space that's maybe not used all the time, you really start becoming a different kind of welcoming entity. And it's really important to be, to self-analyze and to look at things and be like, okay, so tomorrow, let's do it a little bit better here. Let's move this thing over here. And then slowly you'll start seeing all these little pieces come together and it's sustainable and it's built in and every staff member knows it because you're not doing this like 400%, you know, pivot to something. And it's also something as, you know, we're all humans that do it. It's a lot of work, you know, mm-hmm. and our hearts are all in the right place. So to completely renovate a program overnight is impossible because it's not sustainable and you're going to burn out. But can you make really important incremental changes to get to a better place? And I am a big fan of those changes. Start from a strong universal design and then make incremental changes that are sustainable and everyone's aware of. You can get to really amazing places in your program.
Ooh, I love it. Okay, so somebody's listening to this and they're like, oh, okay, I love all of this. But I don't even know where to start. What are like, I mean, it is the suggestion box. So like, what are three suggestions that you would give?
What a great question. Cause I certainly had that moment after my first lead. You're completely right. I was like, we're done plugging lead. And now we're just going to say lead. Every time. But after my first lead, I remember coming back to my place of work and people were like, how was it? And I was like, oh, there's work to be done.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky, maybe not lucky, timing aligned really well because I went to lead right as we started like a historic $30 million renovation, right? Mm-hmm. And that means I could bring some of these lessons in because the famous Betty Siegel had said to me before, remember that like, it's important that architects hear your ADA desires, like your accessibility desires, make sure they're in line with things because it's not just building code. It's also assembly laws. It's the ADA. There's a lot of laws that come into place when you're gathering a huge amount of people together, right?
Right.
And you want to make sure that you understand all of those things. So the suggestions I would make is take a really honest, hard look at your program. Bring in the stakeholders, bring in the populations you serve, if you serve populations, right? Look at the feedback and be honest and leave your ego at the door. Mm. And sometimes that's an external audit as well, but to be able to be like, I am humble in this. I am a creature of failure and learnings. And that is all of us at any point in our lives, but really take stock of your program and what you have spent years dreaming of, what does it actually mean to bring those dreams into the concrete world? And suggestion number two, I would say, is let go of perfection. You're never going to do it 100% correct. None of us do anything 100% correct. You're going to have detractors. You're going to have people that say your ASL interpreting is distracting. You're going to have conflict. And that probably brings me to the third point, is make sure your conflict is always learning-based or generative. So if someone is saying ASL is distracting, or I don't like that they have closed caption in screens for what's going on, or I don't like closed captions on the screen, I think as accessibility assets and being able to advocate for these things, it's important to have those conversations. Right. And it's not just writing people off as you're terrible. People are the product of their environment.
Yes.
And I think we have to believe in some level of inherent good in people. And it's really hard to do that in a sensational news time that we're in.
Yeah.
And a really divisive culture. But if they're coming in, it's like, let's have a conversation. If you like to step out, I'm happy to have this conversation with you. And maybe we won't get to a place where you're like, you've changed my life, but you've introduced ideas to them. I've always said to people, and I have a very broad view of accessibility, it is always rooted in disability justice, but I think it is also services for English as a second language. Mm. It is all gender restrooms. These are services we offer to people to create a more inclusive environment, always rooted in disability justice. And sometimes you're going to have a conversation with someone that will start, that will change their minds right away, right? Mm-hmm. You'll get instant growth. And sometimes they'll be on a year journey of learning more. And sometimes they'll be on a 10-year journey where they're like, oh, I really just need to broaden my horizons with things and I need to engage in this culture. And all of that is okay as long as they're starting the journey. But I would say those are my three suggestions. Be humble and always take an audit of your program and do it a few times a year and always look to where you can build further. Generative conflict, make sure people are learning, make sure people are understanding, be willing to have those conversations. And wait, what was my third suggestion? I got lost a bit in soapboxing.
Let go of perfection.
Let go of perfection.
Glad I was writing it down.
Yes, that is like ultimately so important. I think in everything that we do, it's just really let go of perfection and all of those three things tie together. The more you engage with people, I remember the first time I was teaching seminars, I've presented at LEAD, I've been hired to teach disability awareness seminars. I've worked with USITT, which I'm also a member of. And the first couple ones I did years and years ago, you know, I instantly was like, I could do this better, right? But when you start at something, it's going to feel clunky, it's going to feel uncomfortable, and you want to work through those things and engage with people and learn from the people you're talking to, offer lessons and learnings from people. I think cultural organizations have a habit of gatekeeping as it is, mm-hmm. because they want to be the best in a highly competitive market. I think nonprofits also feel that way, but really be generous of spirit and let go of perfection and engage in conversation and take an audit of the work that you're doing.
I love it. I love it. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Okay, so one of the things that I adore about you is you are passionate about what you do. Where did this come from?
That is a great question. I think of my own experiences a lot growing up, things that stick with you, I think, in ways that you're always not aware that they kind of stick with you. I think doing theater younger, with my hand tremors, people are like, you permanently have jazz hands. And it's like, yeah. And then the 50th time you've heard that joke, you're like, yep.
Oh, no. So
you, take,
oh,
God. You take that, and I'm like not a musical theater person at all. I'm almost about like high dramatic straight plays. But you see the way that ability is often a punchline in kids. And that's usually a showing that they're just not very knowledgeable, right? And it's usually humor is that manifestation of curiosity. And I think we all have things in our families. We all have situations that we've worked through, especially invisible disabilities, family members, different things. And it's like, why is our system not set up to support people? And I also think about our mental health programs in the United States, which impacted some people I knew when I was younger, and our incarceration programs, and why are we so punitive in what we do? And I think I had this realization sometime as a teenager about the way that the world is built for it. So, you know, for listeners, I'm very fair to do a little audio description. I'm very fair, but I'm Latino and Irish, right? So I have that Irish skin, but also really thick curly hair. And I also identify as a gay man. And you see the different ways that the worlds are not built for people outside of one specific identity. And ability is often overlooked, but why do we have to be set up in a, you have to be the fastest, strongest, smartest, most able body, can work independently, and can carry 100 pounds at all times in order to succeed, mm-hmm. and everyone else just falls through the cracks. And taking a moment of perception to the people around me, which I think comes with being biracial, being gay, being worried about what people look at you and perceive and mm-hmm. and see of you, it changes, you know, and it broadens your horizon. I grew up in Camden and Baltimore. My parents did hold themselves kind of up a social class. They are very hard workers. And they've always taught me the value that like no work is beneath you. But I also saw ways that people in other counties kind of looked at this neighborhood in the city. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, why aren't we investing in systems to lift people up? Mm-hmm. And I try to find like, if there is a need, I want to be part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And the more I got involved in the work, the more that it benefited myself. I have a very, I think it would be qualified as like a low impact disability. It took me years to even identify with a disability. It's that my hands just do different things. And that, you know, working in theater, I've had to work in a bar because who hasn't?
Right.
And, you know, when I pour drinks for people, 90% of the time it's fine. But as hydration levels go down, my hands start shaking. I spill drinks and I've been screamed at for it, which is like silly because I can just pour you another drink. And so when you start taking a step back and realizing how little the world is built for something and how someone with various levels of hearing loss just kind of struggle in classrooms and how fast kids on the spectrum get called weird or stupid. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we have to break these things. And mm-hmm. I think anyone who grows up feeling like an outsider at any time, it's kind of stereotypical to say, you know, center your empathy and realize that like, oh, this is something that is like, I don't want to say weaponized against people, but definitely like the system's not built for them. And how can you really impact that change, even if it's in your community, in your family, in yourselves, to really make a difference? So where that passion comes from, it's like a lifelong experiences. It's knowing that my abuela was treated differently because she didn't speak English as her primary language. She eventually became incredibly fluent, but there were still people that made comments about our accent. There are kids in my class who had partial hearing loss that were not treated the same way. And when you start tying these experiences together, there's more in common between these experiences where I think society also pressures us to feel divided in our own boxes. So when someone is discriminated against because of the way they speak, whether it's an accent or a disability, if people are discriminated against because they're gay, because they're Black, because they're different in some way, it's like, oh, okay, we can make progress in one area, but we have to make sure we take that and make progress in other areas because it's hard. It's so hard just trying to figure out how to pay all your bills and have a fulfilling life and do this and do this and do this and do this. And we should really be lifting each other up. So I have a core belief that we can improve as a society, and I don't want to write off the possibility of improvement because I've seen the way that kids can be treated differently and adults can be treated differently and feel more empowered and feel more passionate and ability to do things. And I think the only reason we truly exist is to help each other because it's tough. Not to get too existential in this podcast, everyone, but you know, remember how you felt like an outsider and see if you can help someone feel less like an outsider.
Oh, I love to hear that. My journey is similar. A lot of the reason of why I'm passionate about a lot of the things that I've done is because I know what it feels like to be on the other end of it when it doesn't feel so good. And I was like, I don't want to do anything to perpetuate that. So I want to make sure I do it differently and then also share and help others so that they don't do the same unintentionally. So I hear you. I hear that's probably why we're such kindred spirits because.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. So Let's talk about, I'm gonna go niche just a little bit here. Let's talk about the theater. And there can be, I know some of the examples that I'm gonna ask you to share are specific to the theater, but they can translate, like the, you know, so the area or the building might be different, but the what you did could still translate. So I'm familiar of several phenomenal stories that you have had in helping volunteers who were either on the spectrum or had a disability adjust, especially in emergency situations. I want to talk about that because I know that is one of my biggest questions, especially when we were in the theater, because we're dealing with a lot of people and things that are going on in buildings. But in general, I think that's, well, I can say, I know for me, that was one of the biggest concerns. Well, it's all fine and great, but what if there is an emergency? How can I, you know, let's just say somebody is unable to see and we have an emergency and they are a greeter. How is this person who cannot see supposed to help other people get out of the building if there is a fire, right? I know that there are ways to do it, but if you're not aware and you've never worked with somebody, that's a legitimate like safety thing, right? So it's not even necessarily, it's not that I don't want to, but we have to look at worst case scenario and emergency, like plan emergency out. How does that fit? So I know that you've, I don't know if you've ever had like that type of an example, but I know you have had examples working, like I said, with volunteers who have had disabilities and there were emergency situations and you handled them. Can you share with our audience what that looks like, what that sounds like?
Sure. So I definitely have a go-to situation because it was, it kind of felt like every wrong thing that possibly could have happened, and not like, oh, my scanner went down and someone forgot their tickets. It was like, oh, let's do 6 high stake 10 out of 10 situations at the same time. The very first lesson before I go into the story is as volunteer professionals, as accessibility assets, it's really important that you are so generous in sharing techniques, policies, education, training, because there's things that are going to happen when you as an individual are not on premise. So it can't just live with you,
right,
of how to do things. I was very lucky / overburdened / a victim of my success that I wore so many hats at the theater that I worked at, that I was in charge of the health managers, the bartenders, the box office, accessibilities, events, rentals, eventually the facilities and the IT. And even though that is like, that is too many jobs, you are correct. That is too many jobs. But you can thread a needle between all of those things and create a really strong support structure,
yeah,
because these are all really key roles. So, famous story. It's my favorite to tell. We had made a decision to do a show during the renovation. So that means you walk through the lobby mid-renovation to go into the theater that was all nice and shiny, and to see a show. And the bathrooms worked, but they were still being worked on. Obviously, we can't legally open if we don't have bathrooms that are working. So I was running the show with another individual. I was just supervising because we were in a construction site. We want to make sure everyone's safe. They understand what's going on. It was a really cool preview also to what was happening in the lobby. Each time you came, it was a little bit further along. But something had went horribly wrong in the plumbing. And we later found out that it was like a ball of rags that had gotten placed in. Yikes. I'm not a plumber, so I don't know why it happened. but it caused the bathrooms to flood.
Yikes.
And this was like 20 minutes before the intermission. I was like, okay, we have enough time. We can try to figure out what's going on. And then I get a message from the stage manager that they had this bed that moved on and off stage, this big, massive bed. It was a period piece. So it was on CO2 tanks and one of them blew. So she was like, hey, we have to go to intermission now because we have to figure out this repair. And I was like, this might, actually be the absolute wrong moment to go to intermission. She's like, I don't have a choice because they have to like really look at what's going on. So 400 people start coming out. So I'm sitting in the lobby and from the right, there's all these people coming out. And from the left, there's like water coming down. And I'm like, okay. And a couple of us were on premise. We were trying to figure it out. Like the water had gotten to the point where it could like be up to someone's ankle. So yeah. It was like, we were trying to solve this, but one of our most talented volunteers who had been with us for such a long time, he has autism. Mm-hmm. And he's really great to work with. He was more knowledgeable about that physical space than even I was. Mm-hmm. He had been volunteering there for so many years. He loved the venue. He loved the shows that we did. And he's very tall and with a deep voice. So this whole situation is kind of this like tour, and you start like kind of seeing it in slow motion, right? Because you're like, what problem do I need to solve at the moment? And he became distressed. And he had called my name because he knows he can find comfort in talking with me. So I go to speak with him, and I kind of quickly realized that I have a lot of panic on my hands, and that's never good in an event situation. I have a facility failure on one side. We're trying to fix a stage issue on the other side. And so in talking with him, we chatted through it for just a moment. And I was like, if you feel like you need to take a walk, you're okay to go ahead and take a walk. And I know that walking around the block was a soothing action for him. Mm-hmm. Because what's super important when you're working with any volunteer, really, but also yes. volunteers with disabilities, get to know them. Right. Yes. Just understand yes. who they are.
Yes.
We all have soothing that we do. Every time someone bites their lip, bites their nails, breathes in and out slowly, this is all soothing technique. And yeah. sometimes you run into people that have more visible soothing techniques, and that's fine. But I knew what his was. So I invited him to take a walk. He took me up on the offer because I realized in this emergency situation, the best course of action was actually to have him removed from the situation because it was overstimulation for him. Mm. And I think when you were in a situation of like running a show, working with volunteers with disabilities and things like that, you do have to solve a lot of problems rapidly and at times take out some things that could impede that. And he is very helpful when it comes to moving through the audiences, but I was sensitive to his individual sensory needs in that. And there were people screaming and wailing at us at the time. But understanding his soothing means that I could invite him to take care of himself mm. and I could prioritize that, while then I could switch over and prioritize something else. So it's one of my favorite stories to tell because it's so important in these roles to keep level-headed, to center people and center their own needs. And I wanted to make sure that he was not put into a dangerous situation, because certainly my staff has had to protect a number of volunteers from disabilities from patrons. Mm. Because people will express opinions about stuff that they don't understand and they should not be expressing opinions about.
Right.
But in solving the problem, sometimes it is about helping people out of a situation so then you can also solve the situation from there. It is an experience I never want to go through again. And as I said, it is a slow motion experience. And then suddenly it just feels like it ends really fast. and we got it all fixed, we got it fixed before the next show there. But you also, in an emergency situation, when working with volunteers with disabilities, really working with any volunteers, because they're given their time and they're given their love to what you're doing. You can't always expect someone like who is giving their time of their own free will to be like a major player in an emergency. Know your nurses, know the people who can help you in that.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's like, I just need you to hold this door open.
Yeah.
Right. And if you have a volunteer with a disability on that position greeting people, make sure someone else knows this door has to be held open for people. And that staff, that's volunteers. When you set an emergency plan, which I also have a specialty yep. in doing, you do assign those roles to people, but you also encourage everyone to help people who also need help fulfilling those roles. Because when a panic situation is on board, what I call a soft focus. You can't just be like hyper-focused on one thing that's happening. You have to help people. You have to escort people out. You have to make sure doors are open. You have to make sure things are happening and handling the way that it works. It's not easy, and you can do thousands of preventative measures so it doesn't happen. I don't recommend having a big ball of rags in your plumbing. That turns out was not a good thing that happened for us. And we didn't even discover until afterwards. So we were like, why is this happening? But take care of your people, right? There are problems that you can take care of systematically, but you have to prioritize people. You have to make sure everyone is safe. You have to understand people can help you the ways that they can help you. And I would say when he came back from his walk, he was so good at helping people get back to their seat and start the show. He knew that theater. You could ask him whatever seat you needed to go to. He could point it out immediately. He has been one of my favorite volunteers to work with. He has been one of the most helpful volunteers that I've ever worked with. But in that moment, that was not his forte. And if I can recognize that and know it ahead of time, then you get closer to the solution so that he was then in a place to help me solve the other part of the problem, which is rebuild back up, right? So know your people, know their personalities, know what they're strong at, really embrace what your volunteers and volunteers with disabilities are strong with. And make sure everyone is willing to help each other too. And you can really get through these emergency situations. But that was definitely the one that like sticks with me because it almost feels like a comedy of errors.
Yeah.
Of like what is happening around me right now.
Yeah. And I 1000% know your people, build that relationship. And we talk about it all the time. I say there's two sides to volunteer engagement. There's the systems part, like the logistics, like the who, what, when, where, why, how is it going to happen? But then there's the relational part. And I
absolutely
firmly believe that if you really lock down the logistical stuff and you have that knocked out, right? Like the who, what, when, where, why is running smoothly, it creates room for you to have the relationship with their volunteers, because now the time that you're spent talking with the volunteers is getting to know them. It's not talking about when did you put your hours in. It's not talking about functional stuff. It's talking about you can spend that time getting to know them. So get your systems in place to create that time, because that is what is going to make the difference in the program, the relational aspect. But you cannot have one without the other. You have to have both. And so I just, so it may not necessarily be a theater, but across the board, know your people, know what their strengths are, know where their what their gift is, that whole thing. I love it. Okay. We're getting close to time. So I have one more question. What book are you reading right now? Or when are you writing one? Because you need to, but I guess that's the time, right? So what book are you reading right now?
I do keep a kind of a library of essays, short chapters that I've written myself, right?
Okay.
Of just like, I want to remember these experiences.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, we all dream big. It's like, here are just life lessons from my specific lens of the work that I've done. And maybe that will come together. I do like to read a lot of systematic books, a lot of autobiographies. So I went through Atomic Habits was the book that I recently mentioned. So I read that about a month ago, and it was this incredible journey going from someone who was injured in their childhood to the way that they developed their career about habits and building strong habits of moving forward and how to break down really bad habits. Things like that are really good. There's really great books about the industry in itself. So Jeanette McCurdy just wrote a book about her own experience as a childhood actor. She was on iCarly. And that was a really fantastic read. And that might feel like outside of the scope of what we're talking about. But I think as volunteer professionals and accessibility assets, we have to be invested in the human experience.
Yes.
And learning more and more about human experiences is so key to our sense of empathy and compassion. It's so key to our sense of self-awareness. That is something that I've always said is like, I don't think the theater nonprofits have an abundance of self-awareness on an individual scale. And it's really important to constantly invest in that. So autobiographies are a great way of doing that, especially someone who has a public image versus being willing to open up about a lot of private tragedy and trauma that they are dealing with. So I definitely recommend Jeanette McCurdy's book. Her title isn't the most radio friendly, but if you Google it, you'll be able to look it up. Atomic Habits, as I said, is a great book to read. Any book that is really something about understanding something that you don't know. You and I have talked about Demystifying Disability, right? That is a fantastic book.
Yep.
You were like, hey, this incredible book's coming out. And I was like on Amazon and ordered. Because even though I have more than a decade of experience in this field, there's always something more for me to learn.
Always.
And I want to see something from someone else's perspective. And the lesson that Betty has always taught me that I know behavioral therapists use is when you meet a person with a disability, you have met exactly one person, with a disability.
Right.
Yeah. And they do not define that experience. And I think that's true for all of us, no matter what culture group we represent, we are still at the end of the day, incredibly complicated and complex individuals. So if there is someone that you admire, read their autobiography, right? Like hear it from their words. It's not just a biography of someone who did a study for them. What do they say about their own experiences? So those are two chief books that I'm reading right now. I also have a deep love of geek culture, right? So I'm a video gamer, a board gamer, I'm all those things. And there was a great book called Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, which was about indie gamers, indie game studios, some high, what's called a AAA studio, producing really expensive titles, but it was about this experience of collaboration, problem solving, all this chaos that kind of happens behind doors. And it's another reflection of the human experience. This is something that we only ever see the final product of,
right?
Much like theater. I have such a deep knowledge of working theater, but audience members come in, they see a show.
Yeah.
I remember my dad, to his credit, he, you know, after I majored in theater, I was working in regional theater. He was like, so like, what goes into it? I guess you have like actors and then like someone presses some lights on. And I was like, I appreciate your valiant effort here to connect with me over my professional life. I was like, Dad, it takes hundreds of people to put on a show. It's just not always visibilized, right? So Blood, Sweat, and Pixels was also a really great way to learn of these stories of difficult decisions, trying to get a product to market that you really artistically care about. I do believe video games are art. So if you can read anything that is based in reality, I have a love of fiction, but like these real experiences that people go through, you will be surprised how much your mind opens. And every book I have read has impacted my consultancy in some way. Problem solving, generative conflict, how to compromise and recognize human desires, how to get through a really bad period and know we can never do that again.
Yeah.
We can never ask people to work like this again. We have to take a step back and look at our system before we go into the next big movement. And learn about other industries, because all of it will feel like you're connecting dots and putting together a giant puzzle on how to better the way that you approach your own work.
Okay. So this leads me into my last question for real.
Sure.
Consulting. How did you know it was time to make the jump? Because you were running the place. I won't mention where you were before, but you were running the place. Okay. Like that was your show. Like no pun intended.
Yeah.
How did you make that decision to say, okay, I need to step out? And was it difficult? Was it scary? Was it challenging? Like, talk to us about
that. Definitely, it was difficult and scary. I have pivoted over to a different kind of job that's actually kind of in corporate as well. So I do that in consultancy at the same time. And I was kind of poached, which was also a super weird experience too.
But kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, super cool. And like so flattering as well.
Yeah.
But I was working really hard in disability cultural awareness. I was working with different people. I got approached by a company that's like, we're actually looking for someone who has more cultural competency than what we've seen before, someone who understands how to put systems in place. All of these skills are the same things. If there is someone listening who has reached what they feel like might be the end of their journey, and there's something inherent in that too, in your surroundings, and are like, maybe it's time to jump from nonprofit to corporate or corporate to consulting or something like that. Your skill sets all travel through. You know, we are all still working professionals. And in nonprofits, I always made the joke, it's nonprofit, like no one's making a profit, even the people of us that work there.
Yeah.
But the
little phrase that I've heard was, we're in it for the outcome, not the income.
Correct. Yeah. Outcome and not the income. When you are deciding to make that jump, these skill sets, we're still working professionals. People who are marketers in nonprofits are not less valuable than marketers in corporate.
Right.
They, you know, everyone deserves to get paid what they're worth, and it can be really hard to do that in nonprofits. I think I felt like I was kind of pressing up against the ceiling.
Yeah.
It was very difficult to produce theater during a time of COVID as well.
Yeah.
And there was an exhaustion that was hidden in my core that I think I had to step back and identify. And I also realized that I actually wanted to focus a lot on innovation, and I wanted to focus a lot in a larger scale of assisting people with things. Because unless you dive in and you're super ready to be messy at the start of your accessibility journey, it's really intimidating to dive in. It is very intimidating to step your toe in that water. So if I can help guide some organizations into it, I had started consulting while I was doing that work before. And the consultancy was kind of growing really fast, right? And I'm in the process of, I just got my EIN now. I'm actually formalizing the whole experience of it, which is really great. But I went through this giant renovation at my place of work. So another organization called me and they're like, we're going through a renovation and we want to be better. Can we pick your brain? And picking the brain ended up with, I ended up on a retainer as a consultancy. And I was like, oh, this is really fun.
Yeah.
Right? Because this is, let's dive in. Let's sparse out what you do. And sometimes it's hard. And what you said before is that people view cost as prohibitive. So we all have to do a lot of emotional labor.
Mm.
We all have to push things forward. We have to get shut down 4 times before we actually open that door. We keep banging on it. And a consultancy actually, what I had found, helps me be a third party resource to the people doing that, where it's like, it's not just me that believes this. Come talk to this guy about something. I'm like, yeah, I'll talk to your board. I will talk to your executive director. I will talk to your leadership about all the reasons why you should be doing this. And it's something that it felt like it was needed. And my company also provides audio description services.
Nice.
Those are things that are overlooked a lot. I'm an audio describer. I was trained by amazing audio describers. It's important that we pass that baton forward.
Yes.
We train new audio describers into things. It felt like it was time. And I had been working shows and I've been running processes and I had been putting on more hats and my head was getting bigger so I could hold more hats, not out of arrogance, just the hat capacity. And it was time to also rebalance my own life a bit so that I made sure I always had a foot or at least a toe in innovation and keeping up with things. And it was time. And I think you feel that and you want to make sure you take your skill sets and give back. So I was given a lot over the course of my 10 years from mentors across the field, from everyone at Lead, you know, and then you take and you give back, right? You want to work with people who, I think I also realized, I was like, oh, I'm not like an early 20s professional anymore. I am an early 30s professional. And it's time for me to then pass those lessons forward too, because I think if I had a criticism of the work that we do, both in volunteerism and accessibility, it's that I was running into people who were new to the field who had the same problems I had 10 years ago. And I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah. How is that? Why is
we
that?
Should be,
yeah,
exactly. We should be improving and growing as an ethos. And so I was like, you know what? It's time for me to switch into that ethos. And I've made friends and relationships and contacts across the industry over 10 years. And I've been brought into a lot of cultural organizations and nonprofits that were like, I have this new hire who's going to be doing this work. Can you come teach them? I just finished, I did a class on rentals because I also ran rentals.
Of course you did.
And a lot of people are like, wow, you're doing all these things. It's like, but they're all connected.
Yeah.
Rentals are people and patrons. Yep. And what accessibility services are you offering during your rentals?
Yep.
How can you innovate this so it feels different than the other things you're doing? So I got hired to teach a 3-week seminar on that. And it's like, yes, learn from my mistakes. I want to give you all of the successes and mistakes that I've had so that you can grow and reach an even higher peak, right? I'm not kicking people off the ladder. Use my body as a rung and step and go even higher up. And it's just important that we pay it forward. And it felt like the time to do that. I felt like I learned so much. I had this really strong program. As you said, I was running a lot of things there. And it just hit a time where I was like, oh, I'm not learning as much as I want to be learning. I want to find new paths of challenges. And I want to spread this message in a wider sense so that more people can be more accepting and more inclusive of the different communities they have.
I love it.
It was hard. It was hard though.
Yeah, but that's okay. You know, anything worth it usually is, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Okay. Sorry. Just two more questions. I promise.
Keep it coming. I love it.
For people who do not know what audio description is, do you want to explain what that is?
I would love to. So audio description is a fantastic service in live entertainment. It's not just theater. It's really anything that's heavily visual. There's audio description in museums. There's audio description, all kinds of things. And what it is a verbal description of nonverbal action that is happening in front of you. And that's a very kind of technical, clinical definition of it. But what it means is that you have someone who is on a headset talking into a mic that transmits into a device with one kind of earpiece in so that they can hear what's going on. And you can describe the plot pertinent action that's happening on stage. So you don't describe everything. But the best kind of visual example I have of it is if you're watching a play and it's a silent moment, right? And someone walks in and they walk up to a cabinet and they open it up and they pull out a gun and they look at it and then they put it back in the cabinet and they walk off the stage. There's this silent moment that has happened, right? And the audience who can see are like, ooh, because obviously that is a gun that's going to be used at some other point in the show, right? Check out the gun. And someone who is blind hears people, or low vision, hears people kind of gasping and murmuring or shifting because they're uncomfortable. They have no idea what just happened.
Right.
Right. Because that's a really important moment. It's the same thing in physical comedy. You know, someone does a physical comedy moment and people are laughing, but there's a portion of the experience that is not communicated to them that's probably plot pertinent. So audio describers, we train with each other to give words, feed into words, narrate what is happening on stage so that they understand it. And what is really cool about it is that we train verbiage, timing, how to say a lot of information in a really short amount of time, how to not be overly descriptive, and also time period. One of my favorite things when I taught my group of audio describers and we all work together, my consultancy offers it, we all go to different places to do it, is you have a noun like kissing. We'll go super positive, right? So there's kissing, but there's also pecking or making out or necking if you're doing a show in the 50s, right? And so you kind of train yourself to like use your best friend is the thesaurus, right? And you, one of my exercises I do is I put up the word on the board and then we just throw out every word that can also mean that.
Nice.
And when you break down the action, you're like, oh, these words all mean different things. That's why these words are different. So you want to find specificity in those choices. There's a way difference between if you see two people on stage kiss and two people on stage making out. It's a completely different experience.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure you're capturing kind of that energy through there. So audio description, super fun to do. It lets me see a lot of shows. I then can turn around and give back something to the shows. I just did Fun Home at Studio Theater in DC, which is a fantastic show, run through August. But it really lets me work on a lot of different shows, a lot of really new shows, a lot of different ways to describe them. And I do comedy shows, I do concerts, I do one night engagements. I've worked up at the Abrams Art Center in Lower Manhattan in New York, and they do a lot of kind of pop-up one, two night things.
Nice.
And it's really cool. And it's a way to, you can never give someone the full experience, right? Of the 100% thing, but you can give them a little bit more information so that they understand what is going on a little bit more. They understand these really important plot points. And it's a lot of fun to do.
Well, you know, in all fairness, even if you are able to see and hear, you don't get 100% because, you know, you've left the theater and somebody could ask you, so what happened? And you're like, I don't know. I remember this. I remember this. So it at least just elevates their level of experience to just a lot higher, right? To be able to enjoy and pick out parts the same way when we're, because, you know, sometimes you just fall asleep in the middle of in the middle of the show, it's the whole section anyway.
Sometimes it does happen. Yep.
Wow. You didn't hear that from me. Okay. So, my dear friend, how can people get in touch with you to learn from you, to hire you? How can they get in touch with you?
That is a great question. We are in the process of building up assets for this consultancy firm, Via. I work with a lot of really talented, volunteer, inclusive, accessibility driven people that are part of it. We are a really exciting bunch. You can find me on LinkedIn. It's Alec Lawson, LAWSON. Feel free to reach out over Facebook Messenger to chat with me. I will also put in my bio like email addresses that you can reach out. We do have a Gmail, a volunteer inclusion access at gmail.com. So that we can set up and we can talk. I have done trainings for all kinds of things, cultural competency trainings. I do them on Zoom. I do them in person. And what I love to center is come to me and say the wrong thing. Ask the question that's uncomfortable, right? We're in a learning space and we're going to get to another place, but just don't be afraid for it. So I'll make sure that stuff is included in the bio when Nicole puts this live, but reach out to me on LinkedIn. That's a great place to have conversation. I can talk about accessibility all day long. I might not be able to respond immediately, but I will eventually. And we can engage in really great, thoughtful conversation. So I invite you all to do it, because if you want to be an accessibility asset, that's the first major step. You are that by wanting to be that, and you can start your journey, and it's wonderful.
And now you see why I had to have him on the podcast. Like, it is clear. Thank you so much for, Alec, thank you so much for joining us and being here and sharing your passion. It is clear, like, it has to be, you know, just permeating through the sound waves. And if people are watching, like, they just, it is just clear. And I'm so grateful that we had the opportunity to do this. And I actually have some questions. I was like, oh, I need to reach out to him about this and this and this. So I know I myself am going to do that. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us. And for those of you who are watching or listening, thank you again so much for tuning in and listening to this episode of From the Suggestion Box, Navigating Feedback, the Good, the Bad, and the Say What. If you liked this episode and you feel like it will be helpful to somebody, please like, share, subscribe, all of those things to help spread the word so that we can all elevate together. Thank you for listening and see you next time. Bye-bye.